everybody. You are listening to the Medea podcast series. Medea Medical Education Academy is a global medical education provider dedicated to designing, delivering, and evaluating medical education programs worldwide. Our podcast series wants to bring to you a new way of delivering medical education, allowing to gain knowledge in an easy and accessible way, ideal for continuing medical education. In this episode, we have a talk on Poseidon, Myth and Fertility in Ancient Greece, presented by Nina Papathanasopoulou. Nina is a professor of classical studies, specializing in Greek drama, mythology and its reception. She joined the classics faculty at College Year in Athens in January 2020, where she teaches ancient Greek mythology, religion and literature courses and runs field trips all over Greece for US students who are studying abroad.
It's really my pleasure to be talking to you about the Greek god Poseidon and say a few things also about fertility in ancient Greece. So who is Poseidon and what do we know about him? We know much about him from actually the earliest Greek literature that we have, the work of Hesiod and his work Theogony, which actually discusses the origins of the gods, and also from Homer's poems, both the Iliad and the Odyssey. Poseidon is the brother of Zeus and Hades, and those three brothers divided their areas of ruling, and Zeus has taken over the sky, Poseidon has taken over the seas, and Hades has taken over the underworld. Poseidon is a very kingly god. He rules over a huge amount of space, and his name actually comes from the Greek word pote, that means lord. So he's this lordly god. He rules over the sea primarily with his wife Amphitrite, and he protects ships and seafarers. And he's often represented with a fish and a trident, and he's also associated with horses, and he was known and worshipped as the tamer of horses. Now, specifically in the Iliad and the Odyssey, we sometimes see him as being this protective god, somebody that everybody admires. In this really famous passage of Iliad 13, he actually comes down from the mountain to the sea, taking just three strides. He took three long strides forward, we're told, and in the fourth, he came to his goal. And from the mountain, he reaches the sea, where we find out that he has this underwater palace that's glittering with imperishable gold. He also drives a chariot, so he is known to be very much associated with horses. His horses are bronze-shod, they have bronze shoes, and they have golden manes. So this is one image of Poseidon that is really projected to us in the Iliad. However, in the Odyssey, we actually see a different Poseidon, a Poseidon that's angry, a Poseidon that uses his trident to actually shake the seas and cause sea storms. He pulls the clouds together, gripping his trident, and he lets loose all these storm blasts of all the winds together. So sometimes Poseidon can be this protective god, protecting the ships and seafarers, and sometimes he can be a god that really causes storms and everything becomes destructive. Very famously, he's portrayed, as I said, with his trident. With his trident, he can shake the seas and make these storms. But with his trident, he can also shake the earth, because he's also the earth shaker god, and he's the one who causes earthquakes. Poseidon is almost always presented with the beard. The beard really emphasizes his wisdom, the fact that he has a lot of experience. He's one of the earliest first Olympian gods, and he's always portrayed as being so by having this beard. Other Olympian gods, like Apollo, for example, are always portrayed without a beard, as if they're always young and they look to the future. But Poseidon is one of those older gods that's almost always portrayed with a beard. Now, Poseidon is this, as I said, kingly god, and he has all of this political potency. But his political potency is also reflected in his sexual potency. So he's married, and his wife is Amphitrite, but he also has all these affairs. And with every woman with which he joins, he also has offspring. So he's an extremely fertile god, and this extreme fertility of his is really part of why he is such an important god. Together with Zeus, Zeus and Poseidon are the ones that have the most offspring in the world. So who are Poseidon's offspring? Let's look at some of them. So with Amphitrite, his wife, he actually creates the sea creature Triton, a merman, and then he also has a girl named Rhodos, who gave her name to the island of Rhodes that's in Greece. With another woman, Tyro, he has Pelias, the king of Thessaly. So all the Thessalians, the people in the middle of Greece, felt that their ancestor was Poseidon. And then he also has Neleus, and mythical founder of Messene. This is in the western part of the Peloponnese. So a lot of the western Peloponnesians felt that Poseidon was their ancestor as well. He's also the father of the mariner hero Nafplius, founder of Nafplio, another city in the Peloponnese, which was actually the first capital of Greece. And he's also the father of more popular heroes, like Theseus with Aethra and Bellerophon with Eurynome. He also has a small affair with actually the goddess Demeter. And in order to court Demeter, he turns into a mare. Often the gods transform themselves in other animals in order to mate with women. And so Demeter produces this wild horse Arion from that union. To his discredit, he also sexually assaults and rapes Medusa, and does so in the temple of Athena. So Athena becomes really angry that somebody performed this sacrilegious act in her temple. So she punishes Medusa by turning her into the monster that we now know her, with hair that look like snakes. When she actually turns into this monster and then is decapitated by the hero Perseus, these winged horses appear and are born from her, Pegasus and Chrysaor. So they are offspring of Poseidon too. He also is the father of other monsters like Charybdis, this whirlpool that actually is a great danger for sea travelers. And he's also the father of Polyphemus, the cyclops that Odysseus has to face in his journey, and that many scholars think that he was located somewhere in the southern part of Italy. Finally, Poseidon has an affair with Scylla, another monster that Odysseus has to face. And because he has this affair, Amphitrite actually punishes her by turning her into a monster that's now half snake, half sea creature-y, and she has all these dog heads, and that's why we often hear that she barks and she can attack people with these dog heads that she has. The various number of vases that we have do show Poseidon sort of in courting with other women. So as I said, this extreme production that he has in terms of children, his sexual potency is really a reflection of his political potency as well. Now, apart from being a god that has all of this offspring and a god that's very fertile, Poseidon is also a god that protects cities. And he often wants to take over the protection of cities. So very famously, he actually rivaled with Athena in becoming the protector of the city of Athens. Athena wins the contest and the city is named Athens. Now, we don't know exactly why Athena won. One reason might be because at that time, there were more women living in Athens than there were men. And so all the women voted for Athena and all the men voted for Poseidon. And that's why Athena won that contest. But the Athenians really wanted to remember this story and to honor Poseidon and worship him as well. So even though he didn't become the protector of Athens, there were a lot of sanctuaries around Athens and in the region of Attica that really were dedicated to the worship of Poseidon. Poseidon, as I said, is this really potent god, and he's often confused with Zeus. Some of the representations that we have of him, some of the statues, like the bronze statue that was found at the Cape of Artemisium in the central part of Greece, is a statue that we're actually not very clear whether it's a statue of Poseidon or Zeus, because we don't see what this god is holding in his hand. He could be holding a thunderbolt and therefore be Zeus, but he could also be holding a trident and therefore be Poseidon. You see this god being presented as being wise, with a beard, as being old, and also as being in a position of attack, showing really his muscular body, showing his strength, his virility, and sort of marking him as a kingly and an authoritative figure. Now, where was Poseidon worshipped? Poseidon was worshipped in many places, as I said, in Greece, most of which were actually close to the water. And you can imagine why, since he's the god of the seas and he protects travelers and seafarers, right? He would be worshipped in locations that are close to the water. So Pylos, in the western part of the Peloponnese, Sunion, in the southern part of Attica, and the Isthmus in Corinth were three major locations for his worship. In the Odyssey again, one of the earliest extant literatures that we have in ancient Greece, we actually hear that Telemachus leaves his home Ithaca, the son of Odysseus, and goes to Pylos in order to consult Nestor about his father. And Nestor himself is a descendant of Poseidon. He's a descendant of Neleus, who himself was a descendant of Poseidon. And as soon as he arrives in Pylos, we actually hear that the people at Pylos were sacrificing to Poseidon, and they were saying prayers to Poseidon. So Poseidon really appears as this really authoritative god and a very important god all the way, as I said, you know, from the earliest extant literature that we have that dates to the 8th or 7th century BCE, but we think that was first composed orally much, much earlier, even in the 12th, 13th, or even 14th centuries BCE. And in Pylos, we also found Linear B tablets, so tablets written in this script that was deciphered around the 1950s, and we did indeed find that in these scripts, the people there wrote the names of the gods that they worshipped the most, and we have a lot of mentions of Poseidon in these tablets. Poseidon was also worshipped at Cape Sunion, that southern part of Attica, and his temple still stands there to this day. It's actually a magnificent site for anyone to visit. And it's a temple that can be seen from really far away, both from land and from sea. So seafarers could see his temple from a very far distance, and people coming from land could see his temple from a very far distance so that they could pray to him and ask for protection, especially returning from different trips. Finally, Poseidon was also worshipped at the Isthmus of Corinth. The Isthmus of Corinth was a very cosmopolitan meeting point, and it was a really important commercial port. So you can imagine, again, travelers coming to the Isthmus in Corinth would also worship Poseidon and in some ways thank him for having brought them there in safety. Now, I thought I'd say a few things about fertility and infertility in classical Greece. So one thing that I think is of interest is that ever since Greek antiquity, we actually see infertility as a condition that can be treated and thus can be reversed. In the Hippocratic Corpus that dates from the 5th to the 4th centuries BCE, we do find discussions about how to treat infertility. And we also find discussions that sort of note that women, when they were infertile, and men, when they were infertile, they thought that that was because they were punished by the gods. And so since they thought that infertility is due to the punishment of the gods, they also thought that they could reverse that condition by asking the help of the gods. So just like infertility was thought of as being divine punishment, divine help could help treat that kind of infertility. Now, according to the Greeks, the reasons for infertility were actually either given to the couple. So Aristotle tells us that the cause of a man and a woman's failure to generate when having intercourse with each other resides sometimes in both. So in the compatibility of the couple, sometimes in just one or the other. Many times we actually hear that if somebody has infertility problems, the first thing that they should do is change partners, because maybe the union with somebody else will actually provide them the offspring that they want. On the other hand, we see that both women and men are given responsibility for infertility, but since women were mostly associated with fertility and fertility rites, and the majority of fertility goddesses were women, therefore they're also responsible for infertility mostly as well. So if somebody is responsible for bringing fertility, then they're the ones responsible for taking away that fertility as well. But having said that, we also do have a few texts that recognize that men could have been the ones responsible for infertility as well. And we also have some indications that the Greeks thought that on the one hand, biology could be at fault. So for example, the condition or the function of the uterus and the cervix. But then fertility or infertility could also be the product of psychological and of social causes. So not just related to biology. Now, what kind of remedies were used for infertility? So as I said, number one, we see a lot of suggestions for changing partners. And so the incompatibility between the couple might be the main reason for this infertility, and so changing partners might be something that will help. But then we also see other remedies, bathing in a specific way, washing in a specific way, purging, using smokes and fumigation, eating particular or drinking particular potions, changing one's diet. All of these things are offered as remedies for infertility issues. And then, perhaps most prominently, divine help and divine intervention can be part of fertility treatments as well. So one of the healing doctors, or the healing gods, I guess I should say, in ancient Greece is Asclepius. And we have over 100 sanctuaries of the healing god of Asclepius in all over Greece. And in those sanctuaries, people would go in order to ask for help. And when they would go to those sanctuaries, they would actually often offer a part of their body that they wanted to be treated. For example, we have these votive offerings from sanctuaries of Asclepius of ears, so somebody who had maybe hearing issues, of eyes, somebody who had visual issues, of breasts, and breasts are always associated with fertility. So this might have been somebody who had an issue in their breasts or an issue of fertility, actually. Then we have often male and female genitals presented as offerings to Asclepius. So we know that patients would go to Asclepius, ask for help, dedicate these offerings, and as part of their treatment there that they could get, and they could get, you know, different kinds of physical treatment, sometimes they would also sleep in a part of his sanctuary named the abaton, and they thought that help will come while they're sleeping. So as they're sleeping, they thought that God could come in them and they could heal them while they're sleeping. And we actually have remains of these places of the abatons that had particular locations for the patients to sleep. And they thought, as I said, that, you know, they would get healed during their sleep. Now, another thing that I think is interesting to mention is that the Greeks believed that if a woman is infertile, that actually affects her overall health. And therefore, if a woman is infertile, she needs to be treated. But another thing that we see is that when men is infertile, that actually doesn't affect their overall health. And so there doesn't seem to be such a need to treat a man who's infertile as much as there seems to be a need to treat a woman that's infertile. So an infertile woman, from what we see from the writings of the Greeks, can cause issues in her overall well-being. So that's something that needs to be treated a lot more than if we see this same condition in a man. In addition, this might be because men have more solutions. They can change partners more easily. It was more accepted for a married man to have affairs with other women, where it was not accepted for a married woman to have affairs with other men. And also, it was easier for men to adopt children. And so perhaps because also they have more solutions, that would be a reason why we don't see a lot about treatment of infertility in men. And we also see that it's usually male doctors that are treating women patients that are suffering by infertility. Although we do have also the attestation, especially by the comic poet Aristophanes and our philosopher Plato, that tell us that we midwives called maiai in Greek were actually specialists in infertility and fertility issues as well. However, even though this is the information that we get from the historical and the medical corpus that we have, it's interesting to note that in most of the mythology, so in most of the myths that we have, it's actually the men that appear to be infertile and that seek help for infertility. So just to give some examples of this, Aegeus, who's actually the father of Theseus, he can't have children, and so he goes to the oracle for help. Now, he doesn't say that I can't have children because I have a particular problem, so he doesn't say who has the problem in not being able to have children, but I think it's of interest that he's the one who's responsible for trying to find a remedy for it. And so he goes to the oracle, he's the one who asks for help from the oracle, and he's the one who gets the response from the oracle and has to decipher it and figure out what to do. And Aegeus, on his way back from the oracle, he actually meets Medea, the foreign non-Greek princess that has come back to Greece with Jason. And she appears to be this woman that actually has all of these fertile potions and appears to be a little bit like a goddess of fertility. And she tells Aegeus that she's going to help him. So even though, as I said, in the Hippocratic corpus And the historical information that we have, we see more women who are infertile that are treated by men. In the myths, we see a lot of men who are seeking help, but they actually receive that help from women. Also, Laius, the father of Oedipus, can't have children with Jocasta, and they go to the oracle for help. Xuthus, the father of Ion, also can't have children and goes to the oracle for help. So many men who are infertile seek divine help from the oracle. And, you know, the oracle always gives ambiguous answers, and so there are answers that really need to be interpreted. And many of these answers aren't necessarily related to physical treatment. They might just be about the particular location, the particular place, the particular timing that you have to have in order to have children. Now, finally, I want to end by looking at some of the fertility gods and goddesses that existed in ancient Greece, the majority of which were women. So we see fertility, actually, goddesses all the way from Mycenaean and Minoan times. So the Minoan civilization flourished in Greece during the Bronze Age, somewhere between 3000 BCE and 1500 BCE. And its center was primarily the island of Crete in the southern part of Greece. And there, we have actually found in Knossos, in this famous Minoan palace that exists there, statuettes of this mother snake goddess. And this mother snake goddess seems to have been worshipped as a goddess of fertility. So how do we know that? Well, first of all, breasts are exposed, and breasts are very much a symbol of fertility. And then she also holds snakes in her hand. And snakes are actually symbols of fertility too, because snakes have this unique feature of shedding their skin and of being able to renew themselves. And so they're able in some ways to produce new life by doing that. They're able to recreate, to be reborn, and fertility is very much associated with rebirth, with renewal, with creation. And so this goddess that has her breasts exposed and is holding snakes was a goddess that we think was primarily worshipped for fertility purposes and was associated with the renewal of life. Another goddess that was associated with fertility and the renewal of life was also Artemis. Artemis more broadly, but Artemis of Ephesus more specifically. Artemis of Ephesus had this mass of protuberances on her chest. And we're actually unclear what those are supposed to be. Some scholars think they're breasts. Others think they're testicles. Others think they're eggs. And you can imagine, right? Eggs, they're also a symbol of life. New life is born from them. So whatever they are symbols of fertility. Now, Artemis of Ephesus was associated with fertility, but Artemis, the goddess, was associated with fertility as well. Because Artemis as a goddess is a virgin goddess. She's a huntress goddess. But she's also the goddess who really helps girls transition from girlhood to womanhood, to adulthood. So she really helps that transition, the puberty stages, the stages when a woman first gets her period and she menstruates. And that's why Artemis was also associated with fertility, because those early stages of menstruation, the Greeks thought were really important for how fertile a woman might be in the future. So we know that girls actually in sanctuaries of Artemis all over Greece offered her offerings that were associated with fertility, like breasts and other parts of the body that we discussed. Also, Aphrodite is a goddess of fertility as well. Aphrodite, our goddess of sexuality and of sex, is a goddess of desire and helps couples unite. And what's interesting also about Aphrodite is that in one of her origin stories, in a story that actually Hesiod, in his work, The Theogony, his story about the origins of the gods, presents to us, he actually presents Aphrodite having been born by the male genitals of Uranus. Uranus, the sky god, that was actually castrated by his son Cronos. So Uranus, the story tells us, was suppressing his offspring because he was worried that his offspring were going to be more powerful than he, and therefore were going to overpower him. And so his wife Gaia, Earth, so sky and earth, have joined together in the Greek idea of the world. So the sky above and Gaia below have joined together. But Uranus is suppressing Gaia and her offspring because he's worried that these offspringers are going to sprung up and they're going to overpower him. And so Gaia asks for help from her son Cronos. And what they do is that they castrate Uranus and they throw his genitals into the sea. And it's from these genitals that have been thrown into the sea that Aphrodite appears out of the sea and out of this foam of the sea. And scholars have pointed out that because Aphrodite is born from these genitals, she becomes the goddess of sexuality. But because she's also born from a violent act, from this castration, often love in the minds of the Greek was thought of as being violent and destructive. Now, another goddess associated with fertility is actually Demeter. Her name itself comes from Metir, meaning mother, and De, meaning earth or barley. So she's this earth goddess. Demeter is almost always represented next to her daughter Persephone. And Demeter is often called Karpophoros, so a goddess that bears fruit. And so she's mostly responsible for making the lands fertile and bringing a lot of harvests to people. But she's also associated with bringing fertility to households altogether. So she can bring fertility to the lands, but she can also bring fertility to the people. As the goddess of agriculture, people would actually offer to her the first fruits of their harvest, and they would often offer to her pomegranates. And so she became associated with the pomegranate, and we often see statues holding pomegranates as offerings to Demeter. And maybe you can imagine why the pomegranate becomes such a huge symbol of fertility, right? It has all of these seeds in it, and so it was thought of as being a fruit that could offer a lot of fertility to people. Hera, the goddess of marriage, was also thought of as a fertility goddess, protecting women, particularly in childbirth. And finally, Eleuthia was the goddess of childbirth herself. And as the goddess of childbirth, she's often present in scenes of birth. It's a unique story in Greek mythology where Zeus is able to actually give birth to Athena on his own from his head because he swallowed his first wife because he also doesn't want his offspring to be more powerful than he is. And therefore, he then gives birth to Athena on his own. And since there's no mother here to be present at the birth, Eleuthia, the goddess of childbirth, comes to help with this unique kind of birth. So those were some of the fertility gods that the Greeks had and really worshipped. I just wanted to give a little bit of an overview, as I said, first of Poseidon and then of some myths that are related to fertility as sort of an introduction. Thank you very much.
This podcast is based on the presentation made at the first Poseidon's World Conference, which took place September 9th, 10 in Lisbon, Portugal. To learn more about Madeira Academy, please visit our website madeiraacademy.com.